This work is in collaboration with Antonio Ciampi and other colleagues from McGill University. And the previous method that I'm going to describe is related to censored survival data. And also, I don't discuss issues related to train instability and research approach like ensemble approach. So I'll start with a small introduction with 3 meters. The outline is, I'll start with simple introduction and describe the issue of prognostic classification, and I'll go a brief review of literature review. There are a lot of investigators who worked on tree structure prediction in the case of censored survival data. And I'll describe our particular approach, the REC-PAM approach, that is the acronym standing for recursive partition and amalgamation. And I present some results based on simulation and real data set. Then I will describe some extension of the approach to subgroup data analysis, and I'll give a small example regarding subgroup analysis. This is some introduction regarding terms in binary tree construction. The top part, we call it the root node, that is the whole data set, and then we consider one covariate at a time and start to find the covariate value that results in the highest dissimilarity between the resulting daughter nodes or sister nodes, okay? And there are a lot of split criteria that are suggested in the literature. I'm going to mention those different criteria. And those circle ones are called internal nodes. And then the square ones are called terminal nodes. So the algorithm starts from the root node and selects the most informative split on the basis of a given covariate and considers all covariates in the data set and selects the best of the best split on the basis of a given criteria. And going to describe what is the split criterion. And then the procedure continues recursively up to the point of there is no further possibility to split. That means when the node becomes homogeneous, in this case, in terms of survival experience, or the node becomes so small it doesn't work to further split, then what we have is the largest tree structure. Then we go back from bottom up and start pruning the tree and then construct a series of subtrees. Suppose, let's say, the pruning algorithm works by identifying the weakest link in the structure and closing that weakest link. And we define a criteria how to identify that weakest link. Then suppose let's consider this branch here. Okay, and then let's say this is the weakest internal node. Then we close this node, that means we cut off this branch. By doing that, we get this subtree. And suppose, let's say, we stop at this point and select this subtree. And this subtree, we call it as the pruned tree. Okay, I'll describe the criteria, how we construct the pruning sequence. And then the real question is, out of that pruning sequence, the list of trees, which one is the most honest tree or the least biased tree, and how to identify that subtree? That's the question of this talk. I mean, the focus of this talk. And two nodes resulting from the same parent, we call them sister nodes or daughter nodes. So these are the terminologies that I'm going to use for the rest of my talk. The first part of my talk is in prognostic classification. The problem is, given a data set, possibly censored, we would like to find a classification of individual with classes homogeneous and distinct with respect to their survival experience. Why do we like to have homogeneous groups? There are a number of reasons. In cancer research, we would like to stage cancers. That is, find subgroups within a given disease, but at different risk level for the outcome of interest, let's say death from a certain type of cancer. In cardiology, for instance, in intervention cardiology, they would like, the interventionists would like to have what is the risk score for a given type of patient. On the basis of the risk profile of the patient, they can tailor their management strategy. So there are a lot of medical applications. And the other advantage of creating such homogeneous groups is in clinical trials. In the case of clinical trials, in doing randomization, we would like to have the treatment arms to be comparable as much as possible. So one of the principles in ensuring comparability is by doing stratified randomization. But if there are a number of important prognostic factors that you'd like to stratify on, then the stratification procedure becomes cumbersome. So implementation of stratified randomization, block randomization, becomes difficult. So you'd like to create a small number of homogeneous groups. Within such homogeneous groups, you conduct the randomization, block randomization, so that the treatment arms becomes comparable. So those are the practical application of prognostic classification. And trees would be really the most, you know, candidate for creating the, such homogeneous groups. A lot of investigators worked on this area in the context of censored survival data. So basically using the same engineering of that of CART, but adapting it for the censoring aspect of the data. So the first authors who considered in the case of censored survival data was Gordon and Orshan, and they used what the was certain, sorry, pronunciation, distance. This is just the area between the survival curves as a measure of dissimilarity between the resulting subgroups, okay? So the Davis and Anderson used as the likelihood ratio statistics for the split function and selecting the covariates that resulted in the largest likelihood ratio statistics and constructing the binary tree on the basis of that split function. Champion and colleagues in a series of papers considered the log rank statistics as a split criteria, and later on the partial likelihood ratio statistics as a splitting criteria, and defined a number of information criteria in order to enhance the pruning algorithm, and introduce what is called the information weight pruning. I'm going to describe it. Segal used the log rank statistics for as a split criterion and suggested a simple model selection criterion based on plotting the maximal log rank statistics against the number of leaves of the tree, and then selecting the tree or the size of the tree that corresponds to the characteristic king, where the maximum log likelihood graph starts to change rapidly. And also, I would like to mention that Shampi also, based on his information criterion, suggested the same elbow approach, and they work very similarly. I'll show you a graph how these procedures work. They are easy to use, but the idea is, the question is, can they work as good as that of cross-validation or other computationally intensive approaches? And Ann and Lo also suggested a splitting criterion based on looking at the pattern of the COX residuals, and Law suggested two splitting criterion, the method R and the method M. For instance, the method M is looking at the pattern of the COX residuals and call all those individuals whose residuals are less than the median as class one, and those individuals whose residuals is beyond the median as class two, as group two, and then compare the covariates distribution, like the variance of the covariates, using a two sample test statistics and selecting the one covariate that leads to the largest test statistics. And they proposed cross-validation to decide whether there is a need to further split, and also introduced or used bootstrap in order to decide as to the depth of the tree. Leblanc and Crowley, in a series of papers, they used for the full likelihood statistics as a split criterion, and used the cost complexity pruning as that of the cart in order to construct the pruning sequence and select the honest tree. In the second paper, they introduced the log rank statistics as a split criterion, and also introduced what they call it the split complexity pruning, which is works exactly the same that of the cost complexity pruning. And also they introduced the bootstrap in order to deflect the likelihood ratio statistics, because since you are searching and selecting the maximal statistics is going to be more optimistic. It is going to be inflated. So in order to deflate that, they use the bootstrap approach to correct for that optimism. And also, they introduced the permutation p-value in order to see the significance of a given split. Zihang also suggested a different splitting criterion. Rather than considering the censored time outcome as a single outcome, what he did was consider the censoring indicator as one outcome and the survival time as another outcome. So for the censoring indicator, use entropy as a measure of dissimilarity, and for the survival time, used the quadratic laws, and then by giving equal weights, okay, and using the average of these two splitting criterions used as splitting for constructing the binary tree. And he claims that it works better than other splitting criteria, but I don't know to what extent intensive simulation is done to show that superior performance. So as you can see, the difference in all these different approaches is either in the definition of the splitting criterion or in the way of selecting the final tree or the honest tree. I'll describe our approach, the recursive partition and amalgamation approach. We start, it has three steps. The first step is building the binary tree. We specify as the split function the likelihood ratio statistics, and then we examine every allowable split on the basis of a simple statement regarding one covariate. Is age greater than 60, or is gender male, or is the subject smoker or non-smoker? So one covariate at a time, and selecting the covariate that results the largest split or dissimilarity in terms of survival experience. And the second step is determining the right size tree. Just like the stepwise regression, you have a nested class of models. Then out of these models, to select the one that is the best model, based on the basis of a certain criteria. So we construct the pruning sequence on the basis of what is called information weight. And then out of the pruning sequence, we choose the honest tree or the less biased tree. And since the idea is not only to construct homogeneous groups, but also those groups have to be distinct from each other. They need to have a distinct survival experience. That is important if you are interested in creating a small number of subgroups. So information measures within the RECBAM. One of the information measures is called the information content. It is simply the likelihood ratio statistics comparing this model with the simplest model. Says if you consider two sister nodes, saying that the two sister nodes have different survival experience, and the simplest model is no, there is only one baseline hazard. They are the same, okay, homogeneous. So this is the building block. And this is the information weight of an internal node, let's say G. There are a number of nodes and terminal nodes descending from this internal node. So it is defined in terms of information loss that results by cutting off this branch or all the closing all the descendants of the internal node G. And it can be described as the information content of the largest tree minus the information content of the subtree that is obtained by closing or by cutting off the branch that is rooted at the internal node G. Then, in the structure, we search the branch to find out the link or the branch with the smallest information weight and close it off. And then again, we search for the next one. By doing that, we have the bottom-up approach. We successively close internal nodes till we reach the root node. By doing so, we have a sequence of nested trees or nested models. And the question is now how to select from those nested models the best one. So this is an example of the ELBOW approach, or the maximal split statistics-based approach suggested by Segal, this one, and the broken line is the one that is suggested by Shampi. So regardless of which criteria you use, whether it is information loss criteria or the maximal split statistics, the curves really track each other very well. And they selected exactly the same subtree with five terminal leaves. Okay, and I want to just show using this graph, this is not really obtained from cross-validation, but I want to introduce the idea of cross-validation. Cross-validation was well explained by the previous speaker. We used tenfold cross-validation as was illustrated previously, but the idea is, as the CART authors suggested, that cross-validation is associated with large variability, so where the minimum value is not really clear. So what they suggested was, if you select the next model, okay, the smaller model, that has a cross-validated goodness of fit within one standard error of the model selected by cross-validation, you will be in good shape. Okay, you don't lose much. But at the same time, you have a more parsimonious model. So that is the one standard error rule. Select the tree that is within one the smallest tree that is within one standard error of the tree identified by cross-validation. So in this talk, I'm considering four model selection approaches. One is cross-validation. The other one is the one standard error rule as suggested by the authors of CART. And the other one is the minimum AIC criterion, selecting from the pruning sequence the tree that has the minimum AIC. Okay?
Is there a formal definition for the ELBOW?
Okay, this is the, what it is, a heuristic approach. So it is prone to subjectivism. You know, it depends on the how the individual, the data analyst, sees that this is really the sharpest change in terms of the information measure. So what we did was, we came up with an idea to minimize this subjectivity. What we suggested was, take the consecutive differences of those information measures. Let's say the information loss. Okay? And if you take the consecutive differences and take the ratios of consecutive differences, if there is a large jump in the information measure, then you take at this point, you get a spike. Okay? So that spike is the point where you need to stop further pruning. So that will minimize the subjectivity that is related to simply by looking visually deciding the elbow or the king. So that is how we got around the issue of the subjectivity, by taking the ratio of consecutive differences and then taking the point where there is a spike. Okay, that relates to the king. We used two criteria for assessing the performance of the different model selection approach. The first one is just on the basis of simulation, the percentage of recovery of the correct structure, okay, the underlying structure. The other one is this information content of a tree or a model is, you can think of it as R square, an adjusted R square, okay? The more variables you add into the model, the larger the R square becomes, because you are using the same data to build the model and at the same time to assess it, the goodness of the model, okay? So it is prone to be optimistic. So we have to find to correct for that optimism. So we followed the outline of Efren, and we defined optimism as the information content of the largest tree. You know, the more splits that you do and the larger the tree, the larger the information content of the tree is going to be. So there is some optimism involvement. So we have to find a way to correct for that optimism. If you know the true structure, the underlying structure from the simulation, then you can calculate the extent of optimism that is associated with the largest structure. And suppose you use a certain selection criteria. I think I missed here optimism associated with a given selection criteria, let's say the elbow approach. So the difference in the information content of the largest tree minus the information content of the tree selected by a given selection criteria, let's say the elbow approach, then you can calculate the optimism associated with that particular selection criteria, okay? Then the bias can be associated with a given model selection criteria and can be computed as the difference between these quantities. An overall measure of performance would be the mean square error. And Efren describes another criteria based on the mean square error, the criteria of relative inefficiency. This is comparing the given model selection criteria with two scenarios. The first scenario is the mean square error associated with the ideal constant. This ideal constant is the best scenario where you know the underlying optimism that is involved and you can correct for that optimism. Okay? And the worst case scenario is just taking what is given by the computer or by the algorithm and take that the largest tree as if there is no optimism associated with that, with the largest structure. That is the worst case scenario. So we are comparing the performance of a given model selection criteria against these two, best case scenario and the worst case scenario. So a smaller rel is better. A selection criterion with the smallest relative inefficiency is expected on average to select a structure closer to the truth, so less biased structure. So we are going to compare the four model selection criterions on the basis of these two performance criteria, percentage recovery of the correct structure and optimism or relative. Okay. Whoa, what happened? Okay. We considered four scenarios, 0% censoring and 50% censoring. and presence of 50% presence and absence of underlying structure. And for each scenario, we considered 150 replications, and we considered n is equal to 300. And survival and censoring times independently generated, and the survival time was generated on the base of this structure. And in addition to the covariates that you see in this structure, the covariates that are informative, we have also included three noise covariates, covariates that really didn't influence the survival time. Okay? Yep.
Can you say what you're putting in each node? Are you just putting a Kaplan-Meier estimate or you're putting a
Cox proportional? Okay, what happened? Yeah, that is a good question. The structure is after, let's say, we find the terminal nodes, okay? What we do is we take the right most terminal node as a reference class, okay? The base class. And we take indicators for each of the rays, and we fit the Cox proportional hazards model. So these are the hazard ratios relative to the best.
With all the Z variables that predict
about. Okay, those Z predictor variables are used to construct the structure. Once I have the structures, I use only the indicator variables. Okay? Right. The utmost part, this one.
Is there any reason why it should be the right one or the
left? Okay. It doesn't have. But the thing is, what we do is in the reg farm, okay? We do the split. Always, we send the high-risk group to the left, okay? So consistently, at the end of the tree structure, you have consistently sent the high-risk groups to the right part of the tree. As I said in the previous work or the literature review section, a lot of investigators suggested different splitting criteria. And if you use the likelihood ratio statistics as a splitting criteria, it is going to be computationally expensive if you also involve cross-validation, because you are consistently searching. If you have a continuous variable with distinct values, there are a lot of searching involved. So computationally, it becomes very expensive. So in order to bypass that, rather than using the likelihood ratio statistics, we want to use the score statistics. Okay, under Lehman alternative or under the assumption of proportional hazards, then the score statistics is exactly the same as the log-rank statistics, okay, the non-parametric. So we want to see how they track, how they work, if they similarly work. So here is the true cut points where the highest separation occurs is at this point. So as you see, the log-rank statistics and the score statistics track each other very well. And actually, the most informative split is identified by the score statistics and the likelihood ratio statistics. So this is really comforting. Then we don't need to use the likelihood ratio statistics. We can use the score statistics and substantially reduce the computation. And that is what we did for the rest of the analysis. And these are just bar graphs and looking at to what extent, what is the frequency of identifying the correct structure. Cross-validation, about 60% of the time identified the correct structure. The one standard error rule seems to be very conservative. It misses some of the structures, okay? And on the other hand, the minimum AIC tends to select larger structures. Even though it contains, the larger structure obviously contains the true structure, but still, there are some noise splits that are retained by the AIC, the minimum AIC approach. On the other hand, the elbow approach works closely like that of the cross-validation, I think, with the highest frequency of identifying the correct structure. And using the other assessment criterions here, also, if you can see, the minimum IIC is more optimistic, that's why a negative bias, while the standard error rule is, it is more conservative, so it misses informative splits. If we consider the rail as the overall criteria of performance, then smaller numbers, as we said, is better. Then the elbow approach is the best performance in the case of 0% censoring. And also, in the case of 50% censoring, the elbow approach seems to work well. But what happens if there is no structure in the data set? Well, there is no structure in the data set, and the one standard error rule really performs well. If there is nothing there, it is just simply noise, it can tell you that, just forget it, okay? It selects the root node. And the same through the next best is cross-validation, okay? But the elbow, the minimum bias is still just tends to tell you that something is there while there is nothing, okay? Most of the time. The elbow approach correctly identifies the root node as saying that there is no structure in the data set most of the time, but still there is a tendency at times to give a larger structure. So from this, the overall picture, probably let me show you in terms of the other criteria of selection, the performance here. Here, the smaller number, if you see a relative inefficiency, is obtained by the one standard error rule. The negative sign here is telling us that the one standard rule here is performing, overperforming than that of the ideal constant, okay? And then the second best is that of cross-validation. In the case of 50% censoring in the data set, also the one standard error rule works better, and then followed by the cross-validation. So the trend shows that if there is a structure in the data set, then the elbow approach works well, okay? And if there is no structure in the data set, the one standard error rule works. But in both scenarios, cross-validation is the second best. That is what the simulation study tells us. So this suggests that we can start with a reasonably conservative approach for model selection. And then if that reasonably conservative approach tells us there is some structure in the data set, then we can relax our approach, use the elbow approach to find, okay, the best model or the honest model in the pruning sequence of trees. So on those, on the basis of the simulation study, we suggest a two-stage approach. Either start with cross-validation or the one standard error rule, and then if there is a structure, then use the elbow approach to identify the honest tree. But if the cross-validation or the one standard error rule indicates the root node to be the best model, that is no structure in the data set, then stop there, okay? So this is in the hope of maximizing identification of a structure if there is one, and minimizing if there is no structure in the data set. So on the basis of the simulation, we suggested a two-stage approach. And I'll show you the result of the two-stage approach just in terms of relative inefficiency measure. So if you see, if you remember the first graph, the first bar graph in the case of no censoring in the data set, all the selection criteria identify at least two terminal nodes. That means all of them say there is at least a structure in the data set. So if you apply the elbow, the two-stage approach, first using cross-validation, then the elbow approach, or the two-stage using the one standard error, then the elbow approach, you get exactly the same result as if you are applying the elbow approach, because every one of them says there is a structure in the data set. In the case of 50% censoring, the best approach is to use cross-validation as the first stage and then follow it by the elbow approach. That gives you the same result. But here, the one standard error rule, if you use it as the first stage and follow it by the elbow approach, then you miss some models with structure. So that's why it is the number here is a little bit higher than the one that's obtained by the elbow approach or the two-stage approach using cross-validation as the first stage. The explanation for that is the one stage, the one standard error rule, when there is heavy censoring in the data set, is associated with large variability. Okay? So that component of the variability contributes for the larger number here in the real criteria of performance. So on the basis of this, we suggest that use cross-validation. If there is an indication of structure in the data set, then relax the criteria, use the elbow approach in order to identify the minimally biased structure or model. So that is our suggestion for model selection. And I'll show you an application of... this is simulated data. Each one is 150 replication. I'm going to show you a real data set. And the pattern is the same when there is no structure in the data set, okay? So I'll show an application using cancer data set. We got the data set from the children's cancer study group. There are about 2,700 subjects in the data set. The median follow-up time was about 2,000 days. There is heavy censoring in the data set. We have 18 covariates in the data set. The outcome of interest here is defined as event-free survival, as number of days from study entry to the first major study event, or time to last follow-up. Major study events are defined as failure to achieve remission in the initial treatment phase, or days during induction without achieving remission, relapse after achieving remission, or days during remission, or occurrence of a second malignant neoplasm. The first one and the third and the last one are predictors of imminent days. So that's why they are included as major events. No, we got it from the researchers. It's not a public data set. It's a larger clinical trials group. So using the REC-PAM approach and the two-stage model selection criteria, the largest tree had about 14 terminal leaves. And we selected using the two-stage approach this tree as the minimally biased tree. So as you see, the best prognostic class is given as children with age less than 10, with white blood count less than 20K, and who individuals or kids who received the intense chemotherapy. And the worst prognosis group is kids with greater than 10 of age and platelet number is less than 150K. So in terms of your interactions, and you can think of these three structures as higher level interactions. So that's one way of looking at interaction. So as you can see, these ones are considered as homogeneous groups. But as we said, the interest is not only getting homogeneous groups, but also have to be distinct in terms of survival experience if you are interested in coming up with a smaller number of groups. That may be of interest in cancer staging or in terms of identifying prognostic classes that can be used for stratification in conducting clinical trials for randomization. So if you see these two groups, the log relative hazards are very close to each other. So we might want to amalgamate these two groups. And the same is true for these two groups, okay? Now, if you see the survival curves for the six groups, you can see that these two are close to each other and these two also. So probably we may want to amalgamate these two classes. We can do that formally by using, you know, some statistical tests, or you can just rely on visually. After amalgamation, so we have clearly four prognostic classes. So you can use those prognostic classes in patient management, or you can use them also when you are designing clinical trials. Now I want to shift from prognostic classification to subgroup subgroup analysis. 2 minutes. Okay, I can't do it with 2 minutes. Okay. I think if there are really hardcore epidemiologists may not like this approach, and also if some clinical trials, but this is, I think, the way things are going now. Subgroup analysis. What is subgroup analysis? Subgroup analysis refers to the analysis aiming at uncovering possible variation in treatment effect, okay? In treatment effect in different patient subgroups, such as male, female, young, old, or on the basis of distinct molecular profiles. If you think about cancer treatment, there are some patients that suffer from toxicity, but we don't know why. And there are some patients who benefit from a certain type of treatment. We don't know why. But it would be of interest to identify subgroups that can benefit from treatments. Okay? Can we identify this type of subgroups? Now, you can see in a lot of cancer trials, some sub-studies, they call them correlative studies, where they are interested in identifying a certain group of genes or pathways that can help to see if they can define response to new treatment or new therapy. So this is the idea of subgroup analysis here using the three methods. The question to be answered by this type of analysis is, for whom does treatment work best? So as I said, there are different of views regarding subgroup analysis. It is reasonable to perform subgroup analysis in clinical trials only after the main comparison is shown to be significant. This is what Bulfield suggested. But Gale and Simon also showed that in their biometrics paper that it's possible, the possibility of clinically significant effects within subgroups, while the overall effect is null. This is especially the case where there is a qualitative interaction. What I mean by there are two types of interaction, quantitative and qualitative. Quantitative interaction is a change in simply the magnitude of effect, but qualitative interaction is not only a change in the magnitude of effect, but a change also in the direction of effect. The direction may reverse, okay? For those type of interactions, those are really, you cannot eliminate this type of interactions by a change of scale. So those type of interactions are of interest biologically. Then, now some trialists like Yusuf say such a scenario is very unlikely in clinical trials. Okay, he's not against subgroup analysis, but he's saying the subgroups have to be proper. According to him, proper subgroups are subgroups that are a priori identified. Okay, so if those subgroups are a priori identified, then, you know, you can do hypothesis testing regarding whether treatment effect is there in that type of particular subgroup, or the direction of treatment effect is as specified by you, the way you think. So what we are suggesting is just an exploratory type of subgroup analysis. I'll give you an example from the Veteran Administration. Okay, probably I can stop here. I have 2 slides. Okay. This is an example from the Veteran Administration Lung Cancer Data Set. There are 137 subjects, about 6 covariates, and 6.6% censoring. Using Cox proportional hazard model, the treatment didn't reach statistical significance. Then the question is, does treatment work in certain subgroups? We applied tree structure prediction. I don't go to the details of how we constructed here. we found these subgroups. Okay? So as you can see here, it seems treatment protective in the first group. Okay? The new treatment, the test treatment. In the middle group, it doesn't matter. But in the leftmost group, it is harmful. It is more toxic. So this is the type of interaction I am saying, qualitative interactions. This type of interactions are of interest substantively. And probably I'll stop here. Thank you.